Thank you. It's great to be back. I put the title of the this series, the couple of Sundays that we're spending together. It's called The Crisis in U.S. Congregational Funding, ... And then this Sunday we're going to talk about and what you can do about it. So it should be a little lighter. It was pretty heavy fare last week as we thought about some of the challenges that we face together with so many changes in the world. And we talked about a couple of cultural changes, and this is just to review. We talked about how the world is changing so quickly, and all of us, no matter what our profession, our walk of life, we find that our context is experiencing accelerating change. And that's very disorienting for most of us. No matter what our age, even our grandkids, our children, are experiencing this. Things are changing too quickly. But that's almost become a characteristic of our age, that context is changing so quickly. We talked about the Chulucanas Bridge in Honduras, how it's a great bridge. It was one of only four bridges that withstood Hurricane Mitch when Mitch rolled through that Central American nation. But the problem, obviously, with the bridge is that it no longer serves the function for which it was created. And we noted that there's a lot of congregations, a lot of presbyteries, a lot of denominations that are facing that same situation. They're no longer serving the purpose for which they were created, to connect God's people in God's mission. And so that's a major challenge. And I just want to note this with the strongest urgency possible. I want to be a polite Presbyterian. I don't want to wave any red flags. We don't like to do that stuff. But at the same time, I need to say, we need to really attend to this situation, or our mission faithfulness, our mission effectiveness will continue to decrease. We talked about the great age of mission. When professionals were sent out, professional missionaries, they made a 40-year commitment. They say, I'll go for life, and went. That's not the case anymore. In fact, when I was working as the director of Presbyterian World Mission for the PCUSA, we constantly had these young couples who would say, we'd love to go. And we'd send them to teach at a seminary in Brazil. And they'd do it for a year and a half and say, that was great. And we'd say, we need you to continue. We gave you a year of language study and we've invested in you. And they'd say, well, no, we'd like to do something else now. And they'd move to the next opportunity, often global in scope, but a different thing. And so there's just a significant shift that we're seeing. This was one of the challenges of this era, though, was that it was mission, in a sense, engaged in primarily by a minority, a small minority of mission elites, trained missionaries. I was a professional mission worker for the Presbyterian Church for 30 years. At the same time, the better I functioned in my role, the more local congregations said, oh, we just send money to the missionaries and they'll do mission for us. So the blessing of today's world and the challenge to today's world looks a little bit like this. It's not one unitary dynamic ship of the mission of the church, but everybody's got their boat in the water, right? And so for better or for worse, many individuals and congregations are repeating the mistakes of the past. They're reinventing the wheel. They're overlapping, working in the same area with the same population in different ways. So there's so many of us out there. Sometimes, in fact, there were in Haiti, an NGO, a nonprofit organization, did a study, and within 2 years of the earthquake in Haiti, which was 10 years ago now, there were more than 4,000 U.S. groups that went to Haiti. Well, probably 500 of them were Presbyterians, to be frank. I mean, there's a lot of Presbyterian connections in Haiti. Praise God. But to imagine doing disaster assistance as an isolated individual organization, not coordinating with others, it just boggles the imagination. So that's really one of the challenges. We're much less coordinated, we're much less strategic today than we were 100 years ago when our great-grandparents were writing letters and sending them by ship across to Britain to coordinate with the British missionary societies. So you see we're in a very different mode. Okay, that's what we talked about last week. That sort of shapes the problem when we talked about some of the less effective, less efficient mission strategies that we're involved in. We're going to focus today on the mission decision makers. That's many of you in the room, people who participate in Presbyterian Women or a mission committee, work in the congregation on the work that you all are doing as a congregation in Homewood, and other local concerns and global concerns. These are the decision makers. You are the folks who are making decisions as to the allocation of funds, the sending of people. You gather your youth group and you take them on specific trips. These are really important decisions that you're making. By and large, a vast proportion, more than 80% of our mission decision makers in the Presbyterian Church feel that they don't have the training, the support, or the contacts to do a good enough job. They feel a lot of pressure. It's a complex world out there, and they want more training. They want to be connected with others so they can make better decisions. They want to be able to ask a church in another city, how have you gone about this? What has been your strategy? What's been successful, and what hasn't worked? Talking about this, a book that Balak Klepp and I are writing called Three Stones Make Home, Transforming Congregational Mission, trying to provide some support for mission decision makers like many of you in this room. We talk about three areas, and I'm just going to mention them briefly, and then I'm going to focus on a document we've put together. It's going to be one of the an appendix, actually, within the book, but it's kind of a checklist that we're going to go through together, and I'd like to get your thoughts and comments about it. The three stones, when we talk about three strategies or ways that congregational mission leaders can help their congregations to lead more faithfully and effectively, are these. You see in these vertical, let me see if I can, yeah, you see in these vertical columns the name of the strategy. So we're going to be thinking about a theology of companionship. You know, in the Presbyterian Church for years we've talked about partnership, and I think that's a helpful model. One of the limitations, and I worked in partnership for 30 years, so I'm familiar with its strengths and weaknesses. One of the challenges with that concept of partnership is it sounds a bit like a business relationship, in the sense that I do my part of the contract and you do yours, but if I fall down on the contract, then it's over. There's no more relationship. And so we're looking for a word that suggests more of a depth of relationship. The word companion, from the Latin root com and pan, with bread, it's the people with whom you eat bread. A companion is someone who you have table fellowship with, you're willing to eat with. Now, if I invite you to a meal with me, there's some level of trust among us. You know, I might get pea soup on my mustache or something, and you might see me not at my best. There's a sense of a shared vulnerability in the relationship of a companion. Something that I particularly think is strong in our understanding of a companion in mission is companions are on the road together. We're going somewhere. And so I think there may be a tendency in many of the ways that we were taught to think about mission. Many of us were raised in an era when we think about mission through the lens of the colonial era. And so we think about mission particularly in terms of we as the donors, we as the holders of truth, and we're here to dispense truth and good things to other people. That's part of our obligation as bearers of the truth. Companionship turns that and says we're all together walking towards Jesus Christ. We're seeking to get ourselves on that pathway that will lead us forward together. And on the road, we come in contact with all kinds of folks who will be drawn together as they struggle to follow Jesus as well. So that's what we would talk about in terms of a theology of companionship. We'll talk also about cultural humility, a way to approach the work of mission, whether it's local mission in Homewood or global mission in some of the global partnerships that Westminster has around the world. And we'll talk about some specific strategies that folks can use. And finally, we'll look at the concept of self-development. Self-development being an alternative. In English, we tend to think that the verb development can take an object in the sense of I can develop you, right? My experience with my spouse, let me just say this. When I got into marriage 36 years ago, I quickly learned that my project to make her into the best person she could be wasn't going to go very far. Ruth, to this day, continues to be her own person, praise God. And my efforts to help her become a better person usually fell pretty flat and were not very appreciated by her. Now, that's someone who we share a lot of cultural affinity. We're very close to each other culturally. She may be a northerner and I may be a southerner, but that's one of the few cultural differences. She comes from a religious background home, grew up in the church, she the United Methodist Church, me in the Presbyterian Church, but basically we have a lot in common. Can you imagine the audacity of me arriving in a community in the Congo and assuming that I could develop them. I could, through a project of my own, make them a better community. I had this experience when I was 22 years old, arrived in what was then called the Republic of Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. Got to a place where there had been a lot of Presbyterian missionaries before me. I'd been there for about 2 months, and a congregation way out in the outskirts of the large city that I lived in invited me to come and visit. The development committee had sent an invitation and asked me to come and spend the weekend with them. We gathered on that Saturday, and we talked about their hopes and dreams, and I said, you know, I had looked at some of the statistics, and I knew, they didn't know, but I knew that the major issue for them health-wise was infant mortality. So many children under two were dying because of the poor quality of the water source. Well, I knew that if you just clean up the water source, that's an easy investment. It's a very efficient way to improve the health of everyone in that community. So I started advocating for that. Now, this was my first day in the community, but I was advocating because I knew, in a sense, better than them. They just didn't know, I assumed. So I'm putting all this together in my head. And you know what they want to do? Almost to a person, they want to clear this field and make a soccer field for their kids. And I was like, this is a royal waste. I mean, we could really impact children's health if we just did my project. Why would we work on a soccer field? Well, they were really insistent. And they, in fact, I could not persuade them. And I was doing everything I could to persuade them. They invited me back the next weekend when they were going to actually do the work day, and they began that work day, and they had everybody out. Everybody worked hard, clearing stones, felling trees, digging out three large root systems so that they could have a smooth soccer field. They built the goals. It was quite a production. It was a long day of work. We finished about like 8 o'clock at night. It was already dark. But then they had a great dinner together. The women of the church had made the dinner. And then they brought out for the young people a soccer jersey for each player. It was the first time they'd ever had a soccer jersey in their life. And it said the name of the village and had a number, a special number for each of the players. Well, this galvanized this group of young men. And you know, the next day when they had the soccer game, they won the game. And it was the first time they'd ever beat the neighboring village in a soccer game because they'd never had a field to practice in. Well, that did something to this congregation and to this village, and they were able to grow together in ways that I wouldn't have known anything about. Well, as I was getting ready to leave the soccer game, all the cheers, the excitement, everybody was so happy, and I was like, wow, that was really interesting. I want to think about what happened today. And one of the village elders came up to me and said, we'd like you to come back next week. We'd like to talk with you about a water project we have in mind. So the two surprises. One, they knew where they were going. They just didn't know exactly how to get there, and they found a way. The second learning for me was this. I puzzled for several years after that. What was it in me, in my mental map, in the assumptions that I made, that caused me, a 22-year-old, runny nose, wet behind the ears, young person, assume that I knew more about the development of that village community than they did? I'm still puzzling about that. But I think it's deeply connected with that colonial past. And I would even use the term white supremacy in this conversation. That's a strong term. But I would suggest, I assume that because of my culture, my civilization, the way I was raised, my education, that I knew a lot more than these folks did about their own community. That experience was an eye-opener for me to realize I needed to be checking out those mental maps, my own personal GPS that was guiding me in the things that I said, in my behaviors, the way I was acting in relationship to global partners. I would suggest that as you engage with folks in Homewood, as you engage with your global partners, as you think about different projects that this congregation is engaged in, is invested in, that all of us need to stop and unpack a little bit some of that baggage that we're carrying. All of us have a backpack, a mental backpack, if you will. We need to stop every so often and unpack that and see what it is that we're carrying into those conversations. That's part of this cultural humility and a respect for what we call the self-development process. That is that we can't develop anybody else. I can't change my wife. I'm not able to do that. She's an adult. She's a human being. I can open up. I can remove barriers from her development. I can pop ideas onto the playing field. I can put resources, make them available. But it's my wife who's going to make decisions for herself. Praise God. That's the same case, I would say, and even stronger when we're separated by cultural difference and by distance from other communities. Folks in Homewood, how would we know where they want to go, where God is leading them in the development of their community? But are there ways that we can remove some barriers from their development, from them becoming the people that God is calling them to be? With your global partners, there's a number of strong partnerships in this church. Are there ways that we can, in our interventions, and every time we step into a global community or a local community that's not our own, I would call that an intervention, and we need to be careful about how we conduct ourselves. As we do that, are there ways that we can remove barriers from people's efforts towards self-development? Yes.
I apologize.
No, please. Sure. Sure, and I wouldn't say we have to set aside. I think we have to acknowledge it. We have to own it. We have to say, okay, this is why I'm saying what I'm saying. When I was pushing so hard for the water project prematurely, I had to name, okay, I think I'm making an assumption that I know better than they do. As soon as I named that, it allowed me just to take a breath, take a step back, and see where God was leading them. And the elder came and said, we'd like to do a water project. Would you come and be part of that conversation next week? With regard to our religious beliefs, I would also say, I think intellectual honesty requires us to say, in this conversation, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and that's where I'm coming from. So if we're talking with folks who are not part of the Christian religion, who have a negative experience of the Christian religion, perhaps in this country or around the world, I think there's two parts of that. One is, I think as Christians, we need to bear witness. We are called to bear witness. And so a lot of times in our postmodern world, people want to sort of set aside their religious belief and say, oh, well, I'm not really a Christian, or I won't be a Christian in this conversation with you, in this interfaith conversation. I would say no. We need to be who we are fully. And if you're 100% a follower of Jesus Christ, I think it's helpful to name that. Say, this is who I am, and this is my perspective. I think the beautiful gift that we have, and I think C.S. Lewis's language is so good, we're not the judge. Rather, we're just bringing witness. We're a witness in the trial. We're not the judge. We don't have to pass judgment on the person, but rather we're just bringing our witness. This is what I've seen God do for me through Jesus Christ. This is how my life is different. That's all I can say. And as you look through the testimonies offered in the book of Acts of the Apostles, Peter, John, James, Paul, all of them rehearse the marvelous acts of God in their life, and as they look back in the life of the people of Israel. So yeah, I do think we have to name, that's the positive side. The negative side is I think we have to be clear so that we're not imposing, like I assumed I knew what was best for those folks. I can say, Jesus Christ is the answer for me. My belief is that it's going to be the answer for everyone, but I don't know how exactly. And so all I can speak to is how Jesus has made a difference in my life. My experience with folks in lots of different contexts has been they see that and they begin to ask themselves questions of how would Jesus work for me? What would that look like in my life? And that's when people begin to ask questions and get involved in communities of faith. Yeah, that's when they come to a deeper understanding of Jesus. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
So those are three the three sections, if you will, of the book that are looking at the companionship idea, cultural humility, and the concept of self-development as a way that we can walk together towards the betterment of both communities. Okay, as I mentioned companionship, I mentioned the colonialism. And last week I used the term, and someone came up to me afterwards and I think was surprised by the term. I said the phrase, in some ways, our missionaries got on the wrong boat. That is, and I would have done the same thing. So this is, I'm not slamming previous generations of missionaries. Intellectual honesty requires us to ask the same questions today. Are we being used by global systems in ways that we're not fully considering? But I think in the case of the missionaries, I'm talking about the great missionary era from, say, the early 1800s to the early 1900s, that the great century, as it's called in Christian missionary history, the modern missionary movement grows up right at the precise same time as the colonial movement. And to people in the Congo, to people in Latin America, to people in the Middle East and South and East Asia, they see these white folks coming at them, and they all look alike. In fact, there's a Chiluba, not a proverb exactly. It's not quite so erudite, but it's just a saying. People will say all white people look alike, and so people would call me by the wrong name sometimes. You know, in a church that I hadn't been at, or I'd go to a church, and somebody would call me the name of another missionary, and I'd laugh and I'd say in Chiluba, you know, batoke bonso bafwanangana. And they laugh because all white people look alike, because it is a saying that folks say. At the same time, folks in the Congo perceived these colonial agents from Belgium and missionaries from the United States and Britain and some other countries as being on the same boat. They were part of the same effort to work in the spiritual life, in the political life, in the economic life of the colony. And that puts foreign missionaries at a particular disadvantage, because they're judged, and that deep reaction of many people around the world, of these Europeans coming in and taking their resources, because that's widely the perception of the colonial movement from the receiving end of that. If you're on the receiving end of that, you have a fairly negative view of the colonizers. Well, the missionaries oftentimes got lumped in with that. I wanted to mention, there's a beautiful book that was written last year, David Hollinger. He's an intellectual historian out of Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley. He describes himself, he's the president of the American Historical Association. He's a heavyweight in terms of historians in the United States today. He describes himself as an intellectual historian and an atheist. And in the book that he writes, it's Protestants Abroad, How U.S. Missionaries Went to Change the World and Changed America. And so he looks at what he describes as the missionary matrix, people who give their lives to the church and go into another community where they're a cultural outsider and they live there for years and years, and how that changes them and even their children. And so he looks at, he traces in this history how both missionaries and mish kids or missionary children come back after years of service overseas, years of residence overseas, and actually change America. And he goes through the civil rights movement, the fight to the struggle to take work against the Japanese internment camps during World War II, Thai U.S. policy in Thailand, China, and Vietnam. all were strongly influenced by missionaries. And David Hollinger, as a historian, says, if we had only listened to the missionary kids in Vietnam and in China, this would be a very different world today, because they were advocating for a policy that would have drawn us closer to some of the base movements rather than us polarizing the relationships and going for a short-term gain and we lost in the long term. It's a fascinating analysis, and he's a careful historian who's drawing from voluminous studies. But I was so impressed, because towards the end of the book you get this sense of how his heart is warmed as he gets a sense of this remarkable level of sacrifice that these missionaries were engaged in and how their lives were as transformed as the people who they went to transform. So he, as an intellectual historian, as an atheist, self-proclaimed atheist, he is able to bear witness, I would say, to that remarkable mutuality that God's mission invites us into. I mention all this because that I said that statement sort of caught people off guard, perhaps. I don't know I don't know other ways that it would happen, and so I don't want to be too judgmental about that cute saying of they got on the wrong boat. But at the same time, we have to name that there were mixed results. There were some beautiful things that came out of that 100 years of what we call the Great Generation. The great century, of world mission. The church was planted in hundreds of countries, more than 100 countries. Languages were transcribed and therefore preserved. Lamine Sane, one of the greatest missiologists from the last century, he died last year. Originally from Gambia, he taught at Yale Divinity School in his final years. But he makes a strong one as he pushes back against the people who were critical of the colonial era of missionary work, saying, you preserved hundreds of languages that would no longer be in existence today. You did literacy work. You gave people a sense of pride in their own language, in their mother tongue, because God speaks their mother tongue. When you proclaim the word of God in a people's language, their heart language, you're affirming their culture. You're saying, God cares enough about you to speak your language. That's, in a colonial world, a top-down, a hierarchical, power-hungry world, that's good news. And so Lamine Sani says, don't ever lose that. We can be critical of some of the excesses in the colonial era, but that's a critically important thing. You all know the Presbyterians, Catholics, Methodists, Baptists, all of us, we built schools, we built hospitals. Presbyterians built a lot of universities. I mentioned last week, of the four largest and most effective, most successful universities in the Middle East, Presbyterians founded and built three of them. I mean, the work, the first women's education in the world, women's education as a formal public system, was first introduced in Korea and Japan by Presbyterian missionaries. These were the first experiences in the world, outside of the Western world, where women were educated together with men, with boys. This was an elementary education. So we see some remarkable advances for women's rights, for human rights, because of this testifying to the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'd also say in the bottom there, it freed Europe and the United States from a Europe-bound church. You know, if you follow church history, kind of the good news moved from the Middle East. It was a Middle Eastern religion early on. It moved into Europe, and it became a European religion. It kind of died out, right, after the negatives of the Crusades and that era, the Middle East. And so it became a European religion. Well, this colonial era pushed the good news out into all the world, and now we have experiences. Colleague, he's a graduate of Pittsburgh Seminary, graduated 2 years ago, Ben Nti, N-T-I is his last name. He immigrated from Ghana. He's a Presbyterian in Ghana. He moved to the Washington, D.C. area eight years before starting at Pittsburgh Seminary. He attends Pittsburgh Seminary for 3 years, does a clinical pastoral education program at Veterans Hospital in Pittsburgh, and is called last October, so a year ago, exactly a year ago, next week, he was called to two rural congregations in Brooklyn, Iowa. Not Brooklyn, New York, Brooklyn, Iowa. Well, I got in the pit of my stomach when he called me and said, "Brother, I've been called." I said, "Oh, Ben, where?" He said, "Brooklyn." I said, "Praise God." And he said, "Iowa." And I said, "Iowa?" I said, "Ben, have you been there?" He says, "Oh, yeah." I said, "How do I say this, Ben? Are there many Ghanaians, people of the African diaspora, African Americans?" He goes, "I didn't see any." But Ben understands himself to be a missionary of Jesus Christ. That's Ben. When he moved to Washington, he started a church. When he came to Pittsburgh, he got as much as he could, learning as much as he could about pastoring and starting churches, and now he's revitalizing these two congregations. In the book, I was just fascinated by this experience of a Ghanaian missionary in the United States. And so I did some interviews with about five people on his committee, the PNC, the Pastoral Nominating Committee, who've known him now for about a year and a half. I was in tears as I just smiled over the ways that God is moving in that congregation. As they describe, it's two yoke churches, struggling churches, both have fewer than, one has 80 members, the other has 100 members. But Ben, because of his cultural background and his deep commitment to Christ, is bringing in this understanding of prayer as the key ingredient of his ministry. And so he's calling together 20-year-olds. He has this weekly meeting of about three or four 20-year-olds, 20 to 24 years old, who come and pray with him about the church, that the church could see itself as called into the neighborhood and to be able to minister more powerfully to the neighborhood. A group of men in this congregation, in fact, in both churches, they do it together. It's 180 members for both the congregations together. They're separated by about 8 miles. A group of men, and it's almost 25 men, are part of the Hunt Club. Well, the Hunt Club, they don't come to church between about the second week of September and the second week of November because this is what we guys do, they said. And they wanted to be honest with the pastor. It's not about you, pastor. But we're going to be hunting in these 2 months. And Ben said, "Your primary identity is to be a follower of Jesus Christ. You can't miss worship." He said, "That's okay. We'll have worship on Thursday evenings." Well, the men were like, "Huh? What?" And so Pastor Ben has worship service every Thursday evening to a growing number of men, not only the Hunt Club members who are Presbyterians, but other people in the community. They come together, and guess what? The number of men is increasing, and the yield, the number of animals that they're able to get each week has been increasing, says the men. So they're all coming for the blessing, but Pastor Ben, now, I don't know about any scientific studies, how we work through this and understand it, but I've been so amazed at the way that Ben, bringing his own cultural insights and his deep commitment to Christ, is being able to, just in this first year, to revitalize this congregation. People said that there wasn't, that an African American had never spoken from in the pulpit of either of these two churches. And people said, "We don't think there are any African Americans or African new immigrants from Africa in these two counties." And sure enough, people have started to drive in, some for as far as 20 and 30 miles. And so these congregations are starting to grow in new ways with people, local folks, and folks coming from a more distant drive. That, I think, is what we're seeing as kind of the God's, one of the surprising blessings that's coming to us as mission goes full circle. Our missionaries went out two and three generations ago, and now we're seeing the people who came to faith, their children, are coming back to bless this country in powerful ways. Please, yes.
I had a chance to go to Korea several years
ago. Mm. Korea, yeah.
And there's a very large Presbyterian church. Maybe not Presbyterian, but Christian church in Seoul.
Yes, yeah.
And I was surprised in reading the English language brochure. They have missionaries in the United States.
That's right. That's right. The Presbyterian Church of Korea has 10 million members. we have one and something, a million and, I don't know what, a million and a half or something, and they have 10, they have more than 1,000 full-time missionaries all over the world and more than 100 here in the United States. And that's just one Korean denomination. There's many Korean Presbyterian denominations, yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. We'll see of the top four missional countries, Nigeria, Brazil, and Korea. I'm sorry, in the top 10 countries who send the most number of missionaries, Nigeria, Brazil, and Korea are in that top 10 group. So we see a significant change in the complexion, if you will, of the missionary force around the world. Well, that's those are some of the beautiful things, the reduction of disease, morbidity and mortality in so many countries because of missionary doctors, what they did. These are all the positive consequences of that faithful decision of getting on the boat with the colonial agents. There's also a negative that we just have to be honest about. The missionary presence with the colonial system justified the enslavement of more than 12 million people. The church was providing the theological arguments saying that this was the way that God intended, that there was a theological justification for slavery. Not everybody was doing it. There were some missionaries who pushed back. There was a number of disruptive voices. The Catholic Dominican friar from Spain, Bartolomé de las Casas, argued passionately, letter, book after book, letter after letter. He was a prolific writer, and he pushed back against the less than human status that the Spanish colonial agents were assigning to the indigenous people of Latin America. So we see this time and time again in a beautiful way, but that was really the minority report, if you will. Primarily, the mission, missionary enterprise, and the along with the church, were justifying both slavery and the colonial process that stole the land from indigenous peoples. So I would say that creates, in this last point, it creates a painful alienation and anger in the majority world, that is, in the global South. There's some resentment about this whole missionary thing. I would say there's a surprising thing for sometimes in the United States. There's also, it can get into some supremacist thinking. People, because of that colonial baggage with mission, sometimes when we go out in mission, I see this in some different churches, folks will go and they assume that they know what to do. They go and they take their own supplies and materials and they go saying, we're going to go and do this for them. And so what I'm suggesting is, again, we need to re-examine some of the baggage that we're carrying, slow down and begin to ask a few more questions of the folks that we're called to work with. Okay, well, that's what we're talking about as a theology of companionship. It's a sense that we walk together with the people that God has called us to be in relationship with. So it's an investing in relationship more than in project. And we tend to focus on the projects, the things we can do together. It's a little less awkward. If I come and sit with you for coffee, for example, we both feel better just in terms of our social anxiety. We feel better if we have an agenda to work through, or there's a project here. We need to figure this problem out together in our coffee time, right? If we just come together, and this is harder for males than females, I'm learning over the years, just to sit together with someone, to be with them, that's a challenge for us culturally. And so I would suggest in our mission relationships, we're going to have to become aware of that anxiety and be willing to invest in the human relationships that make mission that give it its power. I think the reason I'm so hard on the colonial period is because I'm trying to think biblically about this. I'm fully convinced that the only way we can engage in mission, that the primary model for our mission is Jesus Christ. And I'm convinced that Jesus, though, as in, I'm repeating the Christ hymn of the second chapter of Philippians, verses 5 through 11, though Jesus existed in the form of God, he takes on the form of a servant. I think that is so profound and so important that that needs to be just like a red flag. Stop and let's pay attention. Why is it that God Almighty chooses the form of a servant in an occupied country does anything good come from Nazareth? I mean, he was from Podunk, in Israel. And all of these things, God uses that to help point the way to a way of engaging in mission, which is from a place of as a servant rather than as a powerful agent. So in the Amharic language, this is an Ethiopian Orthodox rendering of John 13, when Jesus is washing the feet of the disciples. How do you read that text? John 13, when Jesus takes the towel, kneels, and begins to wash the feet of the disciples. Do you know, I need to confess to you, I've sanitized that text. You know, it's just Jesus. Oh, he's such a good guy. That's so nice. You know, isn't that nice of Jesus? I mean, he didn't have to, but he did. I don't realize the scandal of that moment to those disciples. In the Ethiopian context, which is a very hierarchical society, for teacher to get on his knees and wash the feet, dirty feet, of his disciples who were making stupid statements and making mistakes every time Peter turns around, he's putting his foot in his mouth. And still, there's Jesus washing Peter's feet. Well, the scandal of that moment, this in the Amharic language says, Jesus, the God-man, washes the feet of his disciples. And you can see in the expressions, this is from traditional iconography in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, the hand on the forehead, the hand across the mouth, they're expressing shock. In a sense, this disciple, maybe this is John standing behind Peter, who knows, but that disciple is expressing, in a sense, shame. He feels shame because of what this scandalous activity that the teacher is involved in. That speaks to me. I don't think I'm allowing that text to influence me enough and help me realize that the posture of mission is not the mission swag. You know, when we kind of swag in, swagger is the verb, to swagger into a situation because we have all the materials we need, we have all the smarts we need, we know exactly where this community needs to go. It's the opposite of that. It's Jesus on his knees, serving the community. How do we serve the community? How do we remove barriers from its development? How do we help it to articulate, to conceptualize, articulate its own dreams and be able to act on them? That's a very different posture of mission. It's mission from below rather than top-down mission. And I think that's critically important in this missionary enterprise. One of the challenges we have in congregational mission today is we've looked to the colonial era and just taken our talking points from that. And I think we need to reevaluate biblically our engagement in God's mission. So when we think about a posture of cultural humility, the colleague on the screen is Kabibu Bimbulu. He died 2 years ago. But was a good friend of mine, one of Ruth's and my best friends when we worked in the Congo, 20-something years ago, 30 years ago now. But Kabibu helped us a lot with the Chiluba language and really helped us to become fluent in Chiluba. We experienced something very interesting one day. We were with a group of friends. It was a community development seminar, and representatives from lots of churches were there. And Kabibu had on a new shirt. And now Kabibu, I'd known him for like 3 years, and he'd never had a new shirt. I mean, this was pretty big. This is an area where economic concerns are pretty tough. It's a tough situation. People aren't making more than $100, $150 a year. I mean, so it's significant, very low wages, low income levels, and a lot of poverty. Well, we saw that, and Ruth, my wife, said, Kabibu, is that a new shirt? He said, no, it's not. We're like, well, that's not true. That's not right. And so we pressed a little. No, come on, Kabibu. That's a great. Oh, I love that shirt. That's a beautiful shirt. In fact, that's the nicest shirt we've ever seen you in. He said, no, it's not. No, it's not new. And he kept pushing back. And I mean, really, I didn't think he was being truthful. He kept pushing back against it. We finally, afterwards, he said, just let's not talk about this. And so we dropped the subject, not knowing what was wrong. Later that evening, we sat down, and he explained for us. For someone in a what we would call a harmony culture, where the focus is more collective, communal in orientation, not individualistic, but more communal, for someone to get a new shirt causes them to be outstanding. They stand out. And in fact, that's not what you want to be. You want to show that you're investing yourself, your time, your talents in the common good, in helping the whole community. We tend to be, you know, in the U.S. is one of the most individualistic societies. We're a pretty competitive society. And so I kind of, you know, I'm going to wear my Sunday best. I want you to see my new coat or my new pants or whatever I got. But in that context, we realize that faith and love will be expressed in very different ways, because these are folks who are caring for the common good rather than the individual's achievements. Well, that just underscored to me that the weight of that cultural difference that we feel. Last week, we just named some of the characteristics of U.S., what we'd call dominant culture, that is white culture, the culture that I was raised in a suburb of Dallas, Texas. We tend to be more individualistic. There tends to be what we call a low power distance. We imagine that we're all on an equal playing field. Every little boy can be president. I guess we'd say today, every little girl can be president. Anyone can be president, we would assume, right? That's the folklore, at least. We also are fairly risk tolerant. We're willing to take chances on new ideas. We value entrepreneurs, and we pay them handsomely. They're some of the better paid folks. The more risk there's involved in your profession, the better we'll pay you. We're very short-term in our focus. We're investing less and less over time in our grandkids and our kids. We're direct communicators. We say exactly what we think oftentimes. And we value, as I mentioned before, that sense of doing something rather than just being with or investing in relationship. Well, these differences, when you're thinking culturally, have a major impact. I laughed with you last week about this being a perfect storm. Think about your relations, though, whether it's in Homewood or with one of your global partners, or even just as you engage with communities here in Pittsburgh, particularly communities with lower income level, and they may be set up to have a certain kind of relationship with you. One of the things we notice is that because of some of the cultural assumptions that we make, we'll go in thinking we have some answers, and folks in the other cultures, in a sense, have been programmed over the years to assume that we do have some answers, and they need to nod their heads and say yes so that they may receive some of the benefits that we bring. Maybe we'll bring dollars, maybe we'll bring a project, maybe we'll bring employment, maybe we'll bring an infrastructure, an institution. But there's almost a dance, I would say, kind of a diabolical dance that happens, because rather than engaging in the mission of Jesus Christ, we slip into a donors and beneficiaries relationship. We monetize, we commodify the relationship of companions in God's mission. And so they say, okay, I know what I got to do to get the goods. And we say, I know what I got to do to engage this experience and feel good about it. And so sometimes we have a strong motivation in what feels good, and our colleagues have a strong motivation for what's good for them or their particular community. That's a challenge to us. And so to respond to that, in the section, the third section of the book on self-development, Bala and I propose a pretty simple three-part pledge that we call the Zacchaeus Pledge. I'm going to invite you to take one of these and pass it out, if you would, and pass it back.
Thank you.
Yes. Grab one of those and pass it back. You'll see in big letters across this, it says draft. You all are the kind and hopefully happy guinea pigs. Bala and I want to try this out on you, because we're going to be working on this and synthesizing it, shrinking it down, so there's just a page or two, in fact. But I'll invite you to look at this. You'll see that my email is on the bottom of this sheet, and I'd be very interested in your reflections, your questions, the parts of it you don't understand, the parts of it you disagree with, the parts of it that you agree with. I'd be very open to your comments. And in fact, if you're a member of the mission committee or you have some responsibility for mission in this congregation, I would even be so bold to say this is the homework that I'm giving you, because your input, your sense of this document would be very helpful to us. I'm just going to mention some of the high points in it, and then we're going to have some conversation. This is based on the text in Luke 19. You all are familiar with Zacchaeus, the tax collector, the chief tax collector, who has an encounter with Jesus Christ, right? And he's the one who climbs up in the sycamore tree. He's a short man. He can't see over the crowd. So he runs ahead, climbs up into the sycamore tree so that he can see Jesus. And he experiences unconditional acceptance and love from Jesus Christ in a way that turns him around. Sometimes we can assent to a number of doctrinal statements. Okay, I believe that. I guess I believe that. What's the Trinity? You scratch your head. We assent to some affirmations. Zacchaeus has in the Greek they call it metanoia. That's the word for a turnaround, a 180, my kids would say. Zacchaeus does a 180. He's going in this direction. He's got to be one of the wealthier of the tax collectors. He's the chief tax collector. He runs the operation from Jericho to the east. So that's the trade routes. So there's a lot of money coming in on that route, and he's collecting taxes on it. He's skimming off some of the assumptions made, as we can see by the reaction of people who see that sinful tax collector sit at table with Jesus Christ, and they're upset. The power of that turnaround, I think, for Luke, who writes both Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and the Acts of the Apostles, this is a paradigm for those of us who have resources, who have some economic wherewithal in this world. Zacchaeus provides for us a model how we engage once we've encountered Jesus Christ. His model is, I would argue, there's a threefold movement there, and so we've shaped this three-part pledge to be used, and this is basically to be used by mission committees. If you have a mission project group that's working to help mission in a particular area of your church, there's three steps to this. The first step is what we call disciplined self-examination. That's stopping and checking your backpack, looking at some of the assumptions that you're bringing into the conversation as you deal with folks in another community. It invites us to look through the perspective of cultural humility, to be sensitive to that personal and corporate power. None of us think of ourselves as powerful people. We're aware, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, as my grandmother would say. That's for sure. At the same time, when we step into whether Homewood or in communities around the world, we're perceived to be wealthy, intelligent, gifted, and powerful. You didn't even open your mouth, right? And they're already thinking that about you. Because chances are you're the only one in the room who has maybe a full-time job, an insurance policy, a social security system that works, basically, not perfectly, but works. I mean, there's some safety nets in your life. And many of the folks, global partners and local partners, have very few safety nets in their lives. This changes our perspective, and we need to be aware of that power that they perceive us as having, and some of the power that we do, in fact, have as we engage in that conversation. We look at a mission based in mutuality, that is, an understanding that we, together with the folks that we're in relationship with, are on the same path together, walking with Jesus Christ. And then finally, for that section, I'm at the top of the second page, there's some specific tools that we'll suggest in this book. How many of you are familiar with Eric Law's... I messed it up. Yeah, Eric Law's mutual invitation. Have you heard of that? It's a very helpful technique. When you sit together, for example, if you all are working, let's say, with folks served by Casa San Jose, a ministry here in the South Hills in like I said, Beachview, in Beachview area, that works with Hispanic folks, many of them undocumented. When you sit together with folks, if you have a conversation, you'll quickly realize that every time a question is asked by the leader of the group, the hands that go up are predominantly hands from folks from the moneyed side of town, from the more powerful side of town. And you can work as you want to, but it's awful hard to get past that dynamic. There's a cultural dynamic. Folks like me, particularly males more than females, whites more than blacks and Hispanics, upper income folks more than lower income folks, our society socializes us, trains us to know who has a word to speak. And so every time a teacher in a public school asks a question, in my school growing up, my hand went up. I knew the answer, right? You'll find that African-American, this is statistically speaking, sociologically they've done studies, and African-American hands go up much less than white hands, and Hispanic hands even less than black hands, to put it that way. What's that about? Eric Law provides a very simple but helpful strategy, a technique to address that, and it's called mutual invitation. If we're sitting together, I've never been part of y'all's ministry in Homewood or in the different global ministries that you do, but if you think about that space, sitting together with partners and trying to have a conversation, you can realize quickly that most of the suggestions being given are by the North American or the folks from Westminster. Eric Law proposes a way through this by calling it mutual invitation. And so the leader begins and says, Sarah, would you begin? Sarah says what she'd like to say. And then she's invited to ask someone else to participate. And so then they say, would you like to participate? And then you're free to either accept or pass. So everyone has the right to refuse. You're not forced to participate. But then you say your piece, and then Dan, would you be willing to? You share with Dan. And you'd be amazed. People will often cross lines because they're curious. I wonder what you think. John, what do you think about that? And so they invite John. Well, suddenly you get a rich cross-section of opinions, and everyone is enabled to be part of the conversation. Just a simple technique. That's one technique. We'll talk also in another appendix of the book is dedicated to how do we evaluate our mission projects in an intercultural way. How do we know that what we're doing is actually benefiting the community from their perspective? That's a tough opinion to get to, because many folks who perceive themselves as the beneficiary of a project don't want to say anything negative for fear that someone will stop the project. So they say, oh no, this is great. And you're like, I don't think this is great. You know, no one's coming to these events. We're seeing very little skin in the game, participation. What's this about? And people say, no, this is great. You're doing a great job. Keep it coming. This is great. And so we're looking, we provide a technique by which people, even in intercultural spaces, can evaluate together the work that they're involved in. That's the first step, and we call that the discipline self-examination. The second step is putting the poor first. And you see some of the mission practices there that we suggest, studying up on the context, to recognize that it's the people's community themselves and that we're invited into their process of self-development. We're invited to begin with the community's felt needs and build on their structures rather than bringing in our own. Often we'll say, oh, we should start an NGO to do this. Well, maybe, but what are the pre-existing structures in that community? If you're working with a particular community either in town or globally, what are ways that we can strengthen the structures that they already have? So these are different mission practices to support that second step in the pledge, which is put the poor first. Step three, finally, is to work sustainably. I think the business people in the room always tend to get sustainability even before the theologian types. And I just think it's a blessing because a business person say, okay, that's great. Where are we going with this? What's this going to look like in 5 years? Are we going to continue to subsidize this project at this level? Where are we going? And so asking for that exit strategy, or at least having in mind the question around an exit strategy before you engage in an intervention in a particular community, becomes really important. Okay, these are I'll leave those as they stand. Those are some of the three parts of this Zacchaeus pledge. We're convinced that Zacchaeus provides us with a model of mission effectiveness because he does a turnaround. He sees himself in a new light. He reevaluates himself. He takes some steps to begin to adjust the way that he's engaged in this relationship with the poor and the oppressed people that he's been taking some money from over these years. And then in the third step, he works sustainably in the sense that he recognizes when he declares a fourth of my wealth I'll give to the poor, and I'm sorry, half of my wealth I'll give to the poor, and four times whatever I've stolen, I'll return to the people whom I've cheated. It suggests he's going to be in an ongoing relationship, an ongoing review of his own power and the work of his own profession. And I think that that's a powerful indicator of how we need to engage on the long term, sustainably, with the people that we're called to be with. I'm interested in your thoughts, your reactions, your pushback, the questions that you would raise as we think about this, these tools, and I'm off on my time. Do we end at 10:45 or 11? 10:45, yeah, okay. So let me close with this. I'm sorry, I went longer. I was thinking we had more time. What did you hear in this the conversation today that surprised you or encouraged you? Name one thing, just a sentence. Can anyone think of something that surprised them or encouraged them, please?
So you put the thought out there and led me to think that humility is, of course, quite important, but it's also quite unnatural. And I think that bears some careful examination.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, please. Beautiful. Good. Please.
That in many cases, it's like a load off my mind. It's like I don't feel like I have to come to certain meetings having answers. I can just be there, be present, and glad into the body. Versus I'm prepared to change versus something
more. The locus of decision making may not always be just here, but maybe shared or even in someone else's.
But it feels like there's pressure, performance pressure, to go there kind of with that intent. Like, whoa, maybe that's totally the wrong approach.
Good. And that's something to experiment with, isn't it? Yeah, that's great. Good. Thanks, please.
There's possibly one good thing to say about social media promoting globalization, and people are getting used to people of different races and colors and regions and everything.
It really is. That's for sure. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Good. I won't keep you longer. Forgive me for talking past the hour mark. Great to be with you, and may God really bless you in the work that you do as Westminster Church in this community and in the world. Thank you.